WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have something special for the holiday. On a recent trip to Seattle, I had the chance to interview someone I had never met but felt as if I already knew. You may also feel as if you know cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, because in her commentaries on Morning Edition, she's revealed so much about herself. She's told us about growing up in a half-white, half-Filipino home, having a father who left the family, getting into scrapes with her brother, and buying an old accordion so she could learn to play duets with her boyfriend. One of the subjects she's funniest and most perceptive about is childhood. Her weekly comic strip, Ernie Pook's Comique, which is carried by 60 papers, is about two sisters, Marlis and Maybone. Barry's off-Broadway hit, The Good Times Are Killing Me, was about the friendship between a black girl and a white girl. The show just closed. Now Barry is turning the story into a screenplay. In September, I interviewed her at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle during an evening sponsored by member station KPLU. Seattle is where Linda grew up, and about 800 of her fans and friends showed up to hear what she had to say.
This is like one of those things, you know, where like I keep thinking I'm in a coma in a hospital because this is just what I dream up. And then I was in this church, and I was next to Terry Gross, and there were all these people clapping when I walked on.
You know, when I read your comics, I always wonder, like, how autobiographical is this? And I keep thinking, oh, all of these things couldn't possibly have happened to one person in one life. So how much of it is autobiographical?
I'd say that it's probably 10%, sometimes zero at minimum, mostly 10%. Two, it can be a lot more than that. But it can, from zero to 60...
I wanted an empirical answer to this, yeah.
But because for me, it's sort of like, I think that any see, I was thrilled by the fact that fiction was like lying, which I loved doing when I was a kid. I was fascinated with the fact that you could lie. And I was also fascinated with testing the boundaries of how far you could lie. Like in second grade, I told my classmates that I could control bees with my mind. And thinking that if you say, and also the power of the word, if you say it, will it become true? The answer is no. And that was too far. I had to stand up in front of the class in my most shameful moment and admit, no, in fact, I could not control bees with my mind. And write it 100 times, I cannot control bees with my mind, I cannot control bees with my mind. But fiction has that quality of lying, and as an adult, you get paid for it. It's fantastic. So what I do is I'll take a little bit of the truth, like a cutting from a plant or something, and then just grow a big funky tree from it, you know? The hard part for me is sometimes the things get very real when I'm writing them, and then I do have a hard time remembering what really happened to me and what didn't. It's like when you tell a story over and over and over again, an argument you had with somebody where you weren't as smart as you would have liked to have been, but between the drive from when you had the argument to when you get home to your buddy and you tell them the story, you've actually become very smart, and I told them off, and so it's like that.
You've said that your mother lacked a concept of an American childhood. What did you want her to do that other mothers did that she didn't quite get?
I wanted her to take me to J. Jacobs and get me the biggest bell-bottoms that ever were made. I wanted bell-bottoms and I wanted long hair. I wanted her to dress me up like the modest hippie in the world. And so it may have been that she didn't lack an American childhood. It may have been that she had common sense. But you're not wearing those bell-bottoms. I mean, I wanted to look like I was on Hullabaloo at all times. You know. And so there's that. And then also it is difficult coming from a background that's different than a regular American background. It's really difficult. In Filipino culture, adults don't speak to children first. Children are supposed to speak to adults first. So my friends were supposed to greet my mother and my grandmother first. And in American culture, it's just the opposite. So my friends would come and think, well, why doesn't your mom talk to me? And my mother would be going, what kind of friends do you have? You know, and I'd be, peace, people.
Since there was a lot about American childhood your mom didn't get, were you able to get away with more that way, or was it harder to get away with things?
It was just a real fragmented life. I know that there was a way that I was at home, and then there was a way that I was on the street, and then I discovered the bus, and I found that there was a way I was on the bus, that I could get an all-day pass for 50 cents. And my mother is in the audience tonight, and she does not know this. And so, Mom, I'm about to tell you, but when I was in the fifth and sixth grade, I used to get on the bus in the morning on Saturdays and tell my family I was going to someone's house, and I would just ride the bus all day. And I would ride it, and I would ride it down to the post office and get on any bus because I found out it would go to the end of the line and turn around and come back. And that's how I saw the city all by myself. I was really into doing stuff all by myself. And I would imagine when I got on the bus, people would go, who is that child? Who is that girl still riding the bus all by herself? And
so did you go to extremes to prove that you knew what was happening? You knew what was cool?
I definitely had a heavy fantasy life. I mean, heavy, heavy fantasy life where I was constantly imagining. I always wanted to do something every day that no one in the world had ever done. But it didn't matter how small it was. Like, I would take a peanut, open a peanut. No one's ever seen this peanut. And then I would... and then I would write an X on it, like with a flare pen, and then I'd eat it. And then I would walk around the rest of the day just like, yeah. You know? I mean, I was really into that idea, and I used to go to mass by myself. I used to go to church by myself when I was a little kid. My mom would drop me off and walk into church and have that same feeling, you know, like, right, that's right, who am I? You know? And I don't know where it all came from. I mean, I had a heavy, 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 heavy fantasy life.
Well, you mentioned Mass. Maybone in your weekly comic is always saying her Our Fathers and asking God for little favors. Did you pray a lot when you were young?
Yeah, I had a really active relationship with God because I was told when I was really little that God could be in anything, which is a terrifying idea. You know, it'd be like, even spit? It's like, yes. He can be in anything. And I thought of God as being this thing that could hide in anything and was like constantly like watching you. You know, when people said God is watching you, I never thought it was like God is watching you like the crossing guard is watching you. I thought it was like God is watching you, you know? And so I was constantly making deals with God. I mean, constantly making deals. Deals that I still keep. I remember once there was a sermon in Mass about no one should look at dirty pictures. I sort of liked looking at dirty pictures. I was just like this little kid, and they were interesting to me. And so we were all supposed to stand up and vow that we would never do this. And I was about 9, and I knew that would be a lie. I knew at 9 years old I would be standing up and telling a lie to God in God's house. And so I just mouthed the words. I wouldn't let any sound come out. And I made a deal with God that I didn't know what I was going to do about this problem, but every time I saw a beetle laying on its back, I would turn it over for the rest of my life. And I still do it. If I see a beetle, and my friends think, if I see a beetle, like, where's, you know, praying for me? I'm sort of their saint now. You know, maybe Linda will come along, you know. And so I still do that. I turn the beetles over.
If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview with cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, recorded at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to an interview with cartoonist and writer Linda Barry, recorded in Seattle in an event sponsored by station KPLU. You said that most of your friends from the neighborhood didn't go to college.
Yeah.
And that you almost didn't go to college.
Yeah.
Do you often think of who you might have become had you not gone to college and not pursued art?
Well, I don't think there was any way that I wouldn't have gone to college. I just loved school. I still love school. So I think the reason I almost didn't go to college, though, was because I had heard a rumor that you had to have 3 years of a foreign language to get into college. And I never checked this rumor. I just thought, well, it must be true. And so, but I heard there was the Evergreen State College, which was kind of this hippie college back then in Olympia.
Mac Greening went to that college.
Yeah,
right,
man, yeah. Went. And I heard they didn't require. And some, you know, I mean, they, you could just get in by taping a Band-Aid on an index card, and, you know, which is not true, but that's what I had heard. And so so I got in, and I had a great time there.
You were studying painting.
Yeah, first I thought if you're going to pay for school, you should study something you hate so you can get your money's worth. Because I thought, why would you study something you already like and already know how to do? You know, it took me 2 years to figure it out because that's why you're there, because you're paying, and so you should study something you like. But, I mean, it's like going to a restaurant and ordering the worst thing on the menu because, so I studied the history of science, you know, and then after 2 years, I started studying painting.
What were your paintings like?
What did I paint? We first had to have, we had to paint in series, and I had never heard of that before. You know, where you take one idea and you make a bunch of paintings about it. So my first paintings, I was very nervous because you had to name what your series was, and there were all these really cute guys, really smart girls from New York, you know, wearing a lot of black and stuff. And I felt sort of like a Hertz rent-a-car kind of person next to these people, you know. So I wanted to pick exactly the right thing. So for some, and everybody was picking really weird topics, so I focused on cords going into outlets.
Series of paintings of that?
Oh, yeah. 10 a week.
Was it different kind of cords, like a toaster oven cord and a hair dryer cord?
And we can hang and drape them in different ways, in the shadows behind them. And I called it erotic space. I was real. I was very real. And then I was dead serious about doing that. And then I started painting a lot of stuff. But those were my first really powerful series.
How did you get from your series on cords and erotic space into cartooning?
I went through a really bad breakup. I was seeing this guy. I was just nuts about him, and he left me for this really beautiful blonde, you know, who was like smart and nice. And my only moment was clogs were in. Remember clogs? And I kicked his car, and so the clog like made a dent, and I was really happy about that. Nowadays, it'd be really hard to put a dent in a Camaro. But so I had insomnia, really bad, horrible insomnia. So I started staying up at night after all my friends were asleep and making these little drawings with words, because I wouldn't call them comic strips because I was still trying to be a fine artist. And if you said you were doing comic strips, you were out. So I was like, drawings with words. And that my drawings were of women in bars talking to cactuses, who were the men, and the cactuses would have like a million cigarettes. And the words were that the cactuses wanted the women to go to bed with them. And the women were like, I'm not sure about this. So those were my first, and then I had a friend, John Keister, who was at the University of Washington, and he was working on the Daily, the paper there. And so I was sending them to him in the mail, and he was printing them. And I made up a name, Ernie Pook's Comics, because I didn't want anyone to know they were me. And then that's what happened.
Why didn't you want anyone to know they were you?
So that I wouldn't be kicked out of my powerful series of erotic space, you know. So that wouldn't be lessened, marred by some of the work that I was doing in cartooning.
So what reaction did you get from your painting teachers and fellow painters when they found that it was really you?
They didn't for a long time. I mean, it was a couple years.
Well, you weren't proud enough of the work to
look at? I did a little bit of work in the school paper with Matt Groening, was the editor of the school paper at Evergreen. And I did some work for him and eventually got into it. But it really did mean separating. I mean, at that time, now comics are like fine to do, but this was in 79, and it was, if you did anything funny in artwork, then the value went way down. Half price sale. A joke.
So there's a cartoon of yours I want to ask about. It's from 1984. It's called Your Naked Body.
Yeah.
And I wrote down some of this. You write, some of us are very proud of our bodies. Others feel shafted. We know how to stand in front of the mirror to make us look perfect in the mirror, but it's hard to stand this way at the beach. Was there a story behind this comment?
It's so funny because before I was coming here tonight, I was standing in front of the mirror and I was thinking, well, a simple way to look like you're 5 pounds thinner is, you know, when I was doing all that stuff that only looks good from this angle, and from the side you look like some italic, you know, like, you know, and your double chin won't exist if you hold your head like this. It's completely, and I had this thing where I always felt like I didn't have any nice eyelids, so I always like to lift my eyebrows whenever I would look in the mirror. because I just thought that made me look more attractive. And so I have all these pictures, these photographs from junior high school, and I thought I had really big lips. This is before big lips was like, before they were getting implants in their lips. But I saw this picture of me in junior high school where I'm actually, I look calm, placid, but when I look at the picture, I can see that I'm holding my head this certain way and sucking in my bottom lip so it looks half its size, you know, and thinking, God, oh my God, they'll never know. You know?
Another comic I wrote down part of, this is the morning after going out with a real creep. And so the character's sitting there thinking, and she's waiting for this real creep who she really hates to call because the whole thing's made her so neurotic. And she says, and today I'm going to sit here with my college education and wait for a phone call from a man I never want to see again in my life. So,
and if he didn't call.
Yeah. Let it please be him. Oh, dear God. Right. It must be him.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if your sense of feminism and your sense of romance are ever at odds with each other.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. That's woman's greatest dilemma. If I know this, why am I still calling him up? Oh, nothing. Did I leave some lint at your house? I mean, that's the part that I don't understand. I mean, that's the part, that's where you do invoke God, you know, and say, what? I give.
So you're in a relationship now. What kinds of things are at odds in that?
I'm in the early stages. I'm in like the six month heavenly, you know, where everything they do. Tell me that story about how you found a dollar on the floor of a supermarket again. You know, where your friends don't want to hear the word Kevin again, you know. Like, as soon as you say Kevin, you can just see this light go off, and they're going over their laundry list and everything that they have to do, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I'm at that little happy stage. That happy stage where you just think it will last and last and last, and I found it, and nothing's ever going to go wrong.
In your Ernie Pugh comic, did Marlis fall in love with Kevin Turner at the same time?
Yeah.
You fell in love?
I did. Yeah, I did that. I did that. I put his name in my comic strip to get him to like me more. I put his name so he would like me more. And I thought that the readers wouldn't care if his name was Kevin or, you know, Ben Sherman.
Was he impressed with your power?
Oh, yeah. It worked perfectly. It was great.
Your name is spelled Lynda.
Yes.
Now, I have to ask you, when I was in junior high school, my older brother used to say to me, I spell my name Terry. My brother used to say to me, I should change it to Teri. That way I could dot the I with a heart.
Oh, yeah. Or a flower.
Or a flower. You know, and kids are so, like, crazy about their name. Did you make up the Y when you were...
During the age of Aquarius. I definitely stuck that Y in.
And what did the Y give you?
Well... The Y gave me this completely groovy symmetry, you know, when you're doing that bubble lettering that all junior high school kids do. There was a Y in my last name, too, and I was just sort of into that. I gave up that I where you could use a heart or a... But I remember I had seen... One of the biggest things that ever happened to me was seeing Hair, the Broadway musical Hair, and I had won... I was really one of those fast callers, be the third caller and you can win, you know, whatever. I won the Thanksgiving turkey for our house for like 4 years because I would hear the gobble and like... be the third caller. And I won the soundtrack to Hair. And I grew up in my neighborhood, which was, you know, this basically, it was like a very soulful neighborhood. And Black Panther, the Black Panther thing had hit, and there was no way I could be a Black Panther, although I gave it my best. And when I got the soundtrack to Hair, there were these hippie people on it. And I thought, these are my people. This is who I've been striving to use for the bell bottoms. And so I forgot what I was saying because I was so overcome by Hair. What did you ask me? I was like, I just saw the whole musical.
The Y in your name.
Oh, the Y in my name. And so then, no, seriously, I just started seeing the whole thing.
You were distracted by the tear.
Right. I saw it at the Paramount, you know, when Hair came to town and I knew all the words and I got so impressed by this. It's still the most powerful thing that I've seen. And after I saw that, I thought, I want to be changed. And so I... put the Y in my name and showed them. You know, my social studies teacher, what is this? It's me, man.
You do all these comics about adolescence, but do you relate to kids today? Because I think you're drawing a lot on what adolescence was like when you were young, but when you see kids today, do you really feel like you understand them?
Yeah, I mean, I really relate to them. I have a lot of empathy for them, particularly people going through adolescence, because I think that it's a time, it's almost like there's a mythology about it, and it's a really interesting time in a person's life, and it's a very difficult time. And it's a time when we need our parents more than anything, and we also need to separate from them.
Yeah.
And it's a time when lying starts to be a big thing, because you lie to the authorities, and you also lie to your friends about who you are. So it's a very lonely, difficult, powerful time.
Did you mention you lie to yourself, too?
Yes, and you lie to yourself plenty. And music is really important. You get all your philosophy from the radio. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You know, taught me how to live. And then, and so I feel a lot, I have a lot of empathy for adolescents in particular, and children too, because they're just in a funny place, but particularly adolescents, because they're held responsible for all their actions, and they're still sort of kids, you know? I mean, you've seen a 16-year-old drive in a car, and they look like they're 9. It's like, what are you doing?
When you and Matt Groening were first friends and you were first starting out drawing strips and everything, did you think of yourselves as really unlikely candidates for success?
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways. Yeah, I still sort of do that. Matt was, at this hippie college, how Matt was the revolutionary was he was really straight. I mean, straight. You know, he played bridge and... He listened to what I thought was Muzak at the time. Turned out to be Fellini soundtracks, but that's how hip he was. He just listened to the soundtracks that sounded like Muzak, but they were really Fellini. And, you know, so that you don't get it, do you? And so, I mean, but you didn't really think about success. You didn't really think about any of that stuff because it just seemed so, you couldn't imagine being 30, you know? So
right.
I never really thought about any of that stuff. All I wanted to do, though, was to be able to not have a job. It's like, I really wanted to not have a job, and I've succeeded.
Cartoonist, writer, and Morning Edition commentator Linda Barry, as recorded at an event sponsored by member station KPLU at the First United Methodist Church in Seattle. Our thanks to the staff of KPLU and Scott Geibel of Pacific Lutheran University Audience Services. By the way, Linda Barry has several books of her cartoons and a novel called The Good Times Are Killing Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.